fearing what she would find. Instead, she found her gaze transfixed on the victim's face. His mouth had been taped shut, his eyelids drooped at half-mast. The stump of his neck was sealed in a tight bandage that trailed bloodied tubes and tangles of wires, all flowing to a desk-sized machine behind the rack. It was as if someone had stripped the man down to his component parts, separating them each for some macabre study. She could no longer look and swung away, running into Dr. Blake's chest. He caught her in his arms. "What is all of this?" she cried. "We are saving lives," he answered calmly. "Continuing a Russian research program started back in the 40s. They were using dogs back then, discovering how long they could keep body parts alive via artificial means. Even 7 decades ago, using the crude tools available at the time, the researchers were able to keep the severed heads of their subjects vital for days, animated enough to respond to sound, to attempt to bark, to twitch their ears." Amanda shook her head, aghast at such a thing. "Ah, but you see, Amanda, as gruesome as that may sound, those early experiments eventually led to the development of the first ventilator and the first cardiopulmonary bypass machine. A leap forward in technology that saved thousands of lives over the next decades." "But this..." Amanda waved a hand weakly toward the window. "This is just as important and groundbreaking. The animal model could only take medical science so far, and with the accelerating advances of nanotechnology, microsurgery, neuroscience, and cardiopulmonary medicine and pharmaceutical sciences, there is no limit to what we are on the threshold of accomplishing. What we're doing here, experimenting with longevity studies of major tissues, promises not only to save lives, but to extend them as well." She heard the exultation in his voice. He openly worshipped at the altar of cold science, where morality had no sway. He believed as fervently in the truth of his convictions as any preacher, and like any devoted disciple, sought to convert the non-believer. But she wasn't about to drink that particular Kool-Aid. Movement in the lab drew her eye back to the horror show inside. A figure, gowned in a one-piece hooded clean suit, stepped from a rear chamber carrying a tray of surgical tools. The worker noted the audience at the window and looked over. Above the white mask, Amanda recognized those cold, watery eyes. Petra. At the same time, she remembered Blake's praise for his nurse's ghoulish skills, a talent to be applied to the child in her womb. She stared between Petra's face and the disembodied head. Did they intend to do the same to her boy? Petra's earlier words rang in her ears. "I'll relax once we have the fetus on the vivisection table at the lab." Amanda stared at the tray of sharp stainless tools. Blood drained to her legs, making her swoon. "Why?" she cried inside. "How could her child be important to these grisly longevity studies? What were they looking to find in her baby boy?" Petra crossed and dropped the tray atop a workstation. Steel clanged on steel, as sharp as a gunshot. The eyelids of the corpse popped open. Dead pupils stared back at Amanda. She screamed, letting all the day's horrors crash out of her. She fell to her knees, felt something give way deep in her belly. Hot fluid washed down her inner thighs. Dr. Blake dropped beside her, cradling her under one arm. "Her water's broke," he called to Petra, then turned his attention back to Amanda. He patted her leg. "It won't be long now." Amanda closed her eyes, knowing at last where she was. "I'm in hell." 11:45 p.m. "She's in heaven," Gray said, speaking to the group gathered in the suite and to Painter back in Washington. With the satellite phone on speaker, he stepped again to the large window that overlooked the city and beachfront. Far out, near the horizon, a glow shone against the midnight sea, like the reflection of the moon. But it wasn't a reflection or the moon, but another celestial body. Gray fogged the glass with his breath and drew on the window with his finger. A five-pointed star. The new island of Utopia out there is in the shape of a starfish. Gray faced the others as Painter listened on the line. The boy back in Somalia said that Amanda was being taken to heaven. Maybe he misinterpreted Utopia, translating the name as best he could as a heavenly place. Or maybe he heard the destination of the kidnappers was shaped like a star, a piece of the heavens. Or maybe you're grasping at straws, Kowalski said. Seishan stood with her arms crossed, similarly unimpressed. Gray remembered their brief, intimate moment in the bathroom. In that fleeting instance, the worries of family and mission responsibilities faded. He existed in the simple purity of touch and possibility. With his mind cleared, the nagging puzzle stuck in his head broke through the muddle of his awareness. The answer burst forth fully formed, shining with the certainty of truth. But maybe he was the only one convinced. Even Painter put a non-committal spin on his revelation. It's something I can look into. Maybe by morning. We can't wait until morning. Amanda could be moved again or harmed. We need to take advantage of the hours of darkness left to us. You're talking about putting a lot of resources to bear on a hunch, Painter argued. You could burn your cover. Expose the fact that you know Amanda's still alive, all for nothing. I know I'm right, Gray said.
How can you be so sure? Seishan said.
Gray returned to the window. Because of the breakwater around Utopia, the same as can be seen out the window surrounding the Palm Islands. He fogged the glass again with a hard breath and filled in the rest of his map of Utopia, drawing in a crescent breakwater around the starfish-shaped island. A moon and a star, Gray said, poking at the symbols. A gasp rose from Seishan. Kowalski swore. Tucker shrugged. I don't get it. Gray glanced at him, remembering the man knew nothing about the guild. It's the root symbol for a shadowy organization, one that's committed acts of terrorism around the world. The director already suspected this group might be behind Amanda's kidnapping. Now you tell me, Kowalski grumbled. If I'd known that, I would have set this one out. Tucker still shook his head. The crescent and the moon. You can find that emblem on most Arab national flags. The Emirates is an Islamic country. The design of the islands might simply be representing that Muslim symbol. Painter agreed. He's right, Gray. But you've convinced me enough that the island is worth investigating. I've ordered a team to assemble an intelligence brief on the place. I already pulled a picture off the web, photos showing the towers under construction on the main island. Impressive. Several are already occupied by businesses, with the remainder of the spaces nailed down by corporations from around the world. From what I'm seeing, security is tight around that island. That's why I wanted to head out there tonight. Go in dark. No good. It sounded like Painter was reading from a report. They've got a radar monitoring system that circles the entire island. They'll know you're approaching from a mile away. Then we can get as close as we can and use scuba gear to... I may have a better way, Painter said, letting out a long sigh. There's someone in the area I can reach out to. His name came up during the initial intelligence sweep of Dubai. A deep-sea salvage operator. He's got a pair of submersibles, possibly something we can use to ferry your team to Utopia. He's been doing survey and engineering work on the seabed for an underwater hotel being constructed offshore. Hydropolis, Gray said, remembering the latest addition to the Dubai waterfront. That's right. From the sound of the director's voice, Painter was still not too keen on involving a third party, especially this person. Director, if you don't trust this guy, it's not that. He can be trusted. He's performed many high-security clearance projects for the government, even for the military. Then what's the matter? Again, that heavy sigh. He's Lisa's ex-boyfriend. Kowalski turned away, mumbling under his breath. Oh, that's not going to be awkward. Chapter 20. July 2nd, 4:34 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Charleston, South Carolina.
And Jack's agreed to help? Lisa asked.
She stood by the open balcony door on the second floor of Harborview Inn, a historic building in the heart of downtown Charleston that overlooked the river and a waterfront park.
He did, Painter said. Even agreed to keep this midnight mission a secret from the rest of the crew of the Deep Fathom. He'll be taking the sub out personally.
She closed the French doors, returning inside to the air-conditioned luxury. Her room was appointed with a four-poster bed and period pieces, and featured an exposed red brick wall and working fireplace, a richness of accommodation to help bolster her cover. She hadn't thought about Jack Kirkland in some time. She had been fresh out of UCLA Medical School, working under a National Science Foundation grant to study the physiological effects of deep-sea work on the human body. Jack had been the captain of an 80-foot salvage ship, the Deep Fathom, manned by a team of scientists and treasure hunters. The two had a brief, fiery relationship that burned out as fast as it started. It was all physical, but not from lack of trying. Lots of trying, multiple times a day. She smiled at the memory. Though almost a decade had passed, it felt like a lifetime ago. What happened to that bikini-clad, bronze-legged girl? A pang of melancholia swept through her. Painter redirected her to the present, stoking the worries that had died down by the distraction of his call.
And Kat's still not back?
No.
She checked her watch. It was almost 5 o'clock. She'd been back at the hotel for over 2 hours and expected Kat to join up with her shortly thereafter. They weren't supposed to communicate with each other until reunited at the hotel to keep their distance from one another.
And you've not heard anything from her? She asked.
Not a word. But when you called an hour ago, I pinged her recording devices. The pen camera in the reception area is still operational, but offered no clue to her whereabouts. The other devices in her possession were never activated, and the remote hacking device you planted continues to transmit data. So far, they've not found it, and we've been gathering reams of data.
Anything about Amanda?
I got the profiles you emailed, but we've hit a wall when searching for Amanda's medical file. A firewall. I have a skilled engineer trying to sap away under that digital barrier, but it's delicate work to keep from raising alarm bells. Still, if Kat had been caught, I doubt our surveillance devices would still be operational. They'd sweep the place clean.
So then where is she?
I don't know. The clinic doctors could be running tests, or maybe she got nabbed by in-house security for trespassing and it's taking extra time to talk her way out. Or maybe it's as simple as traffic. She does have to take the bus back to the city.
Lisa let his words calm her. Due to construction delays, it had taken her an hour to wind her way across town to reach the hotel, and Kat would have to change buses twice to get here. Maybe Painter's right.
Still, she couldn't escape the feeling that something was wrong.
Wasn't the original plan to rendezvous at the hotel at 6 o'clock? Painter asked.
That's true. But why hasn't she at least reported in to you if she'd left the clinic?
Painter's reply took too long.
I don't know, he finally admitted. We'll keep monitoring what we can. We'll give Kat until 6 o'clock to break silence before we make a move.
Lisa knew that would be an agonizingly long hour for her.
Painter spoke in her ear,
not talking to her this time, but to somebody who must have stepped into his office. Though he lowered the receiver away from his face, she still heard his voice sharpen.
Send me everything, he ordered,
then returned to Lisa.
Kat activated a second pen camera. Technicians are downloading the camera's SD card and sending them to my computer.
A knock on the door drew her attention.
Someone's at the door, she said.
In her ear, Lisa heard a commotion over the phone. Then Painter swore brightly.
Lisa, don't answer it! Get out of there!
Wood splintered as someone kicked the door. Panic spiked. She twisted away. Another kick sounded behind her. The door crashed open. 4:46 p.m. Kat let her hand drop away, accidentally dragging her purse off a metal table beside her gurney. The contents spilled across the floor, but she was too weak to stop it from happening. It had taken all her effort to lift her arm and groggily reach into her bag, fumble for one of the surveillance pens, and press its disguised clip to activate the camera inside. No video would be recorded inside her purse, but audio would still be picked up. The same could be said for Kat in her current drugged state. Her vision remained a blurry pinpoint. Her stomach churned queasily. But she could hear well enough to know someone came running into the small room, drawn by the clatter of her upended bag, recorded inside her purse, but audio would still be picked up. The same could be said for Kat in her current drugged state. Her vision remained a blurry pinpoint. Her stomach churned queasily. But she could hear well enough to know someone came running into the small room, drawn by the clatter of her upended bag. Looks like she was going for her cell phone. A shadowy shape dropped next to her bed and began scooping up the contents of her purse, shoving them back inside. It sounded like the orderly from earlier. The next voice supported that supposition. Judging by the frosty New England accent, it had to be Dr. Marshall, the woman who cattle-prodded Kat into convulsing submission.
Roy, I thought you said she'd be out for another 10 to 15 minutes.
From the dosage, her body weight, she should have been. I just stepped out to grab a fresh gown before stripping her for the intake exam.
Didn't I warn you she was fit? Robust? She's not like the usual malnourished, strung-out subjects that land here.
You should have anticipated that, Roy. She might have injured herself.
Sorry. It won't happen again.
Judging by the gist of the conversation, they remained unaware of Kat's true identity, blind to her connection to Sigma. But where was she? Her head lolled around, trying to get some bearing as to her location. She innately sensed that not much time had passed. All she could tell was that they'd moved her to another room, likely within the same facility. The space looked sterile. Too many bright surfaces pained her eyes, and the air definitely had the antiseptic smell of a hospital. Painter's instinct had been correct about the fertility clinic. Something was wrong here. But what? Why had they drugged and kidnapped her?
I'm not ready for her exam yet, Dr. Marshall said. So you might as well take her to her cell.
Cell?
Let her shake off the rest of the sedative, the doctor finished. She'll be easier to work with if she's not as limp as a rag doll. Besides, the sooner she learns to behave, the better.
Dr. Marshall still held her cattle prod, tapping it against the gurney, emphasizing who was boss. The orderly, Roy, hauled Kat on the gurney and drew her out of the room and down a poorly lit corridor. Though there were no windows, she sensed she was underground, in a basement level. Roy stepped to a locked door and used a key card hanging from a lanyard around his neck to open a set of swinging doors. Stepping to the head of the stretcher, he wheeled her through and into a large circular ward, painted a soothing light blue with tables scattered around and a television playing silently in the background. A set of double doors lay directly opposite, painted a warning shade of red. Likely it was locked as securely as the doors into the ward. The orderly swung her gurney to the side. She noted the living space had bookshelves, a showering facility, and all along the periphery, small rooms, cells, a dozen in all, each sealed by metal-framed glass doors. A single woman stood framed in one of the doorways, behind glass, dressed in a blue smock, her hair shorn to a crew cut, wearing an expression of fear and sorrow. She placed a palm against her glass door, either as a sign of solidarity or to warn her off. But there was nothing Kat could do. At least not yet. She leaned her head to the side and studied the red steel doors, only now noting the raised symbol spanning that exit. It was a cross,
adorned with stylized representations of helical DNA. She sensed that whatever secrets were hidden at this clinic, the answers lay beyond that threshold. But right now, she had another door to worry about. Roy reached a vacant cell, there seemed to be many, and used a master key to unlock the door and haul it open. Next, he shouldered Cat up into his arms. Dr. Marshall's descriptive use of the term ragdoll was appropriate. She couldn't keep her feet under her. Her arms felt cast in cement. The orderly hauled her to the unmade cot in the room and tossed her on top of it. Stay out of trouble this time. Cat had enough strength to watch him leave. As he shoved the door shut and wheeled away the stretcher, she spotted her purse atop the gurney. She pictured the surveillance device inside. Dear God, let someone be listening. 5:02 p.m., Washington, D.C. We're still not picking up any audio or video, a technician reported. Another analyst called from across the room. I've got security feed from Harborview coming up over here. Painter pointed to the tech. Keep monitoring all of Cat's surveillance devices. He stepped toward the analyst. Show me that feed from Lisa's hotel. Painter crossed Sigma's communications nest, moving the eye of a hurricane with him. He had other intelligence analysts and agents laboring across the banks for computers and monitors that formed a semicircle across the back of the room. To his left, an adjoining windowed office looked into the space. It was Cat's command center, her nest within the nest. A single monitor glowed in that dark space, illuminating the young face of her chief analyst, Jason Carter, who hunched over a keyboard working on a separate project. Out here, chaos reigned as Painter sought answers to the fate of Cat and Lisa. He kept one ear fixed on the flow of information in the room, while his left hand held a Bluetooth earpiece in place, awaiting any more audio from Cat's surveillance device. A pair of wall monitors displayed the video from the two pens she planted. One showed the reception area of the North Charleston Fertility Clinic. The other was dark, receiving no video. Painter had heard the initial conversation that was downloaded after the second pen was activated. It sounded like someone had drugged and kidnapped Cat and was now holding her prisoner. But after that, nothing. The feed had fallen unnervingly silent for the past 12 minutes. At the moment, he didn't know if Cat was still at the fertility clinic or taken somewhere else. They tried to track her disposable cell phone, but ended up hitting a blank wall. Either reception was being blocked, or her phone's battery had been stripped out. He was ready to contact the Charleston law enforcement, have them storm the clinic. But to what end? Cat might not be there, and if she was, her captors would likely kill her before warrants could be issued. Such an effort would also lay bare Sigma's continuing investigation into Amanda and the Gant family. That must not happen. His mind raced through countless stratagems, while his heart pounded in his throat, fueled by yet another fear, another unknown. Where are you, Lisa? When he received Cat's transmission, he'd been on the phone with his girlfriend. When he recognized that Cat was in trouble, his anxiety shifted immediately to encompass Lisa, especially when seconds later an analyst burst into his office to inform him that the hack into the clinic's computers had suddenly got severed. He got a brief warning out to Lisa, then heard the crash of a door in the background, and the line went dead. I've got the hotel feed now. The agent pointed to a monitor in front of him. A stuttering image flickered, silent, showing three assailants in a hallway, all wearing ski masks. So they knew about the cameras. One knocked on the door, shook his head. Then another stepped back and kicked the door in. The three rushed inside, vanishing out of view. Without a camera inside the hotel room, there was no telling for sure what transpired after that. As he watched, Painter found himself holding his breath. He had to force himself to breathe. Panic wouldn't serve either Lisa or Cat. After Lisa's phone went dead, he had immediately called hotel security and reported the break-in. The head of security called back within 5 minutes,
It had been the longest 5 minutes of his life. When he finally heard back, he was relieved with the report, but far from settled.
"We'd chased the intruders off, but the hotel room was empty. We found a purse and a cell phone and luggage. No occupant."
Painter watched the same scenario play out again on the screen. A two-man security detail came racing down the hall, but the three assailants dashed out, one shooting at the approaching guards, forcing them back. The three then took off, disappearing down a stairwell. A neighboring analyst swung around in his chair.
"Director, I have Harborview security again.
Patch them through."
When he last spoke to the hotel, they were still searching the premises for Lisa. His earpiece clicked, and a gruff voice could be heard shouting orders, before centering back to Painter. It was the head of security.
"I'm sorry to report, sir, that we found no sign of your girlfriend anywhere in the hotel. I've interviewed staff and guests. No one saw any woman being manhandled off the property."
Painter felt the smallest flicker of relief. If Lisa wasn't in the room or spotted by the hall cameras or staff, then she must have escaped out the window. The man on the line came to the same conclusion.
"The police are on the scene, but it appears to me that she fled."
"Thank you. If you hear anything or learn anything, you'll be the first I call."
Painter pictured Lisa running scared through the streets. No money, no phone. Doing her best to keep ahead of the hunters and not knowing whom to trust. She needed to reach a public area, get access to a phone. Then he could facilitate a rescue. He already had field operatives flying into the area. There'd be boots on the ground in Charleston within the hour. Hopefully, by that time, he'd have more information on Kat's whereabouts, too. Painter glanced at the technician assigned to monitoring Kat's surveillance equipment. He got a shake of a head in return. Still no new feed from Kat's second camera. With an extra moment to think, Painter paced the length of the communications nest. He began putting together the most likely scenarios. Somehow, Lisa's cover got blown after the discovery of the wireless router hidden in the head clinician's office. And since Kat's cameras were still functioning, her cover must still be intact. No one connected them together yet. It was the only silver lining in this black cloud, but he'd take it. Still pacing, Painter turned to find his way blocked by Jason Carter. The young man was rail thin, former Navy like Kat, only 22 years old. According to Kat, the tow-headed kid was some sort of gifted savant as an intelligence analyst. He also knew his way around computers. He'd been kicked out of the Navy for breaking into DOD servers with nothing more than a BlackBerry and a jury-rigged iPad, or so the story went. Still, Kat had nabbed him up in the aftermath for Sigma. Jason's face was paler than usual. He blamed himself for accidentally alerting the clinic during his attempt to hack the last firewall and for exposing Lisa. He was also deathly worried about Kat. The young man worshipped at her feet. To keep the kid distracted and focused elsewhere, Painter had assigned him to finish the intelligence brief on Utopia.
"Director, there's something you should see."
He lifted an arm toward Kat's office. Painter followed him and closed the door. He could still smell a whiff of jasmine in the air, a ghost of its former occupant. Jason led him to a large computer monitor. Upon it spun a 3D rendering of the star-shaped island of Utopia. The surface of the man-made superstructure bristled with towers, clustering up each leg, rising in height from the tip to the center, like the spines of a starfish. And in the middle rose the tallest of the spires, appearing like a molten pyramid whose tip had been stretched taffy-like into the sky to the height of 500 feet.
"Where did you get this schematic?"
"Made it myself."
"That was fast."
Jason shrugged.
"Before all hell broke loose, you had me already doing a search into the various corporations and businesses involved with Utopia. I just pulled the architectural schematics from each building, paired them with their GPS locations on the island, and had it all rendered in 3D. The hard part was showing the levels of completion of each phase of the various towers. I shaded the completed projects in gray. The other ghostlier sections denote floors or phases of construction either unfinished or still in the planning stages.
Impressive. Can you forward this schematic to Commander Pierce's team?
No problem, sir, but that's not why I wanted to talk to you.
He waved to the screen.
This was all busy work while I waited for my data to compile on the various businesses invested or renting space in Utopia. Let me show you. He tapped the screen, and the grayscale schematic burst forth with tiny patches of color in every imaginable hue, filling in office floors and apartment spaces. Each color represents a different company with vested interest in Utopia, Jason explained. 216 in all.
Painter gaped at the view.
Gray's team faced a daunting task to hunt through that corporate maze for Amanda. But apparently, Jason wasn't done. You also had me search business records and financial reports to discover the true owners involved.
Painter nodded.
He had assigned Jason to strip away the shell and dummy corporations, to expose the various front and holding companies, all to discover who was truly investing time and money in Utopia. To reveal the real peas under all those fake shells. That took some work, Jason said with a proud grin, and hit a keystroke. Now watch. On the screen schematic, the various dots and splashes of colors began to change, blinking through a cascade of shades, then settling and blending together, until most of the screen glowed one uniform color, a deep crimson. Once the shell game settled out, Jason said, I discovered 74.4% of the island is actually owned by a single parent company. Painter felt the cold creep of dread in his gut. He could guess the answer.
Gant Corporate Enterprises.
Jason glanced up at him, his eyes surprised. How did you know? What is the president's family?
Painter cut him off and leaned closer. Rotate that schematic to get a bird's eye view of the island.
Jason manipulated a toggle to swerve the view up and over the star-shaped island to look down upon that crimson corporate tide. The kid whistled appreciatively.
Amazing, Jason exclaimed. The pattern forms a perfect cross atop the island.
A Templar cross, Painter mumbled, picturing the symbol he'd studied only days ago, the mark of the guild. Doubt evaporated inside him. The Gants are the guild.
And Gray's team was sailing blindly toward their newest stronghold. Chapter 21. July 3rd, 1:20 a.m., Gulf Standard Time, Dubai City, United Arab Emirates. Gray led the others down a long dock that cut through the center of a massive marina. A full moon in the blaze of Dubai's skyline turned night to day here, while jazz music tinkled across the water from an open-air nightclub. A soft breeze blew gently off the sea, cooling the warm night and smelling of ocean salt and diesel fuel. The tiny harbor lay at the tip of the man-made island of Palm Jumeirah. They were to meet their escort at a berth in a remote section of the marina where fewer eyes were likely to pry. To Gray's left, the giant trunk of the artificial palm-shaped island stretched 2 kilometers to shore, sparkling in the night with hotels and residences, divided by an 8-lane motorway. He hadn't appreciated the sheer magnitude of this archipelago until here on its shores. Each engineered palm frond was 1 mile long, lined by villas and mansions. And to his right, across the water from the marina, stretched the 7-mile-long breakwater crescent, turned into a playground of hotels and water parks. And 2 more palm projects were in development, each bigger than the next. The largest would be 7 times the size of Palm Jumeirah. Another of Gray's party was also fixated by the enormity of everything in Dubai.
I guess size does matter, Kowalski said, gaping at the mega yacht docked at the upcoming berth.
It had its own helicopter tied down at the stern, and it wasn't even the biggest boat here.
Somebody's compensating for something, if you know what I mean.
Seishan strode alongside him. We all know what you mean, Kowalski. It's why none of us have commented on those cigars you keep sucking on.
He took out his stogie and frowned at her.
What you talking about?
She shrugged.
Tucker bent down and unclipped Kane from his leash. The shepherd, freed at last, trotted ahead, nose in the air, tail flagging high. The dog had been confined to a leash while in Dubai, not the most dog-friendly city, but out here in the marina at this late hour, no one was around to complain. His handler hung behind them, lost in his own thoughts. Gray followed Kane down the dock. The number of empty berths grew as they neared the end, leaving the opulence and grandiosity of modern Dubai behind. Moonlight shone off the dark water ahead, no longer competing with the reflected dazzle of the city's towers and playgrounds. A slight breeze took the edge off the warm night. Looking out to sea, with stars twinkling and with the call to prayer echoing hauntingly from the shoreline, it was easy to get transported back to another time, to the medieval era of Ali Baba and lost desert kingdoms. Despite the excesses and extravagances of Dubai, the ancient world still glimmered through the cracks, a shimmering mirage of past glories.
About time you all got here,
a voice called out of the shadows of the next berth. The only evidence of his presence was the smoldering tip of a cigar. The figure stepped into a pool of light cast by a pole lamp. He wore a pair of black Bermuda shorts, flip-flops, and an unbuttoned white shirt. On edge, Gray searched to make sure the man was alone. Kane seemed to have no such qualms. The dog ran forward and greeted the newcomer warmly, bouncing a bit on his front legs.
"Stay down, Kane," Tucker warned. "I don't mind him at all."
The man leaned over and gave the dog a vigorous rub.
"Reminds me of my old dog, Elvis. He was a shepherd, too. German, that is. What's this boy?"
"Kane's a Belgian shepherd," Tucker said. "A Malinois."
War dog, I'm guessing."
"That's right. Army. Retired."
"If you don't mind me asking, what was Kane's rank?"
"Major."
Kowalski glanced at Tucker.
"Wait, Major Kane? Your dog outranked you?"
Gray knew that wasn't unusual. A military dog always ranked one level higher than their handler, so any abuse was a court-martial offense. Not that Tucker would ever harm his partner. Straightening, the man thrust a hand toward Gray.
"Jack. Jack Kirkland."
Introductions followed all around. Their escort stood over 6 feet, with salt and pepper hair and a chest full of coarse hair. From the scarring down one side of his body, he'd seen some action in the past. The man also carried his rugged, ageless masculinity with a boyish grace. Even Seishan was struck by it. Gray had never seen her so enthralled. He heard her giggle at something the man said. Seishan never giggled. It slightly pissed him off, a reaction that caught him by surprise. In a matter of minutes, the man had charmed everyone on his team. Or almost everyone. Kowalski shook his hand.
"What are you smoking?"
Jack glanced at the cigar balanced in his fingers.
"Cuban. El Presidente." "Oh, man."
Kowalski stared at his own stogie, disappointed.
"I've got a whole case aboard the Ghost."
Jack nodded his chin in the direction of the dark berth.
"I'm sure I wouldn't miss one if it happened to grow legs and walk away."
Jack headed off in that direction. Kowalski stayed put.
"That guy really gets me."
Gray shook his head. "Okay, now I've lost everyone." Seishan sidled up to Gray, brushing his shoulder and leaning closer.
"Wow."
That one word pretty much summarized the man. Gray sighed and followed Jack toward the berth. No wonder Painter was so hesitant to drag this guy back into his life.
If I were Painter, I wouldn't want Jack within 1,000 nautical miles of Lisa. At least the man was wearing a wedding ring.
Here she is, Jack said, stopping ahead. My new pride and joy, the ghost.
Gray didn't see anything moored in the neighboring berth. Jack leaped from the dock as if to plunge into the water, but he landed on a firm surface. Only then did Gray appreciate the docked vessel as it rocked under the man's weight. Even still, it was hard to discern its presence against the dark water. The submersible's bulk remained below the waterline. Only a conning tower-like hatch protruded above the surface and a fraction of its upper deck. What made it so hard to discern, what made it blend so well with the water, was that it appeared to be sculpted out of glass. Jack tapped his toe against the clear surface.
Her shell's made out of a new borosilicate polymer, strong as steel, yet with a low refractive index, perfect for underwater viewing. And the deeper you go, the harder the glass becomes. Up to a point, of course. I'm not planning on testing that limit today.
I see why you call it the ghost, Seishan said.
She's my new love. Comes with all the bells and whistles a guy could want.
He ticked them off proudly.
The latest sonar and communications equipment, fly-by-wire joystick, electronic buoyancy controls, expanded air supply. But what really gets me purring is her sexy curves. I designed her after the old X-1 mini-submarines. Sleek, fast, and seductive.
Kowalski snorted at the hyperbole.
Do you need a moment alone with her? Do you still want that cigar?
Jack countered. Kowalski hung his head a bit.
Sorry. I should know better than to insult another guy's girl. She's sexy. Very, very sexy.
That's more like it, Jack encouraged with a huge, bawdy grin.
Come on aboard. Let's get you all settled. We have a bit of a jaunt to reach Utopia, but then again, whoever said getting into heaven was easy?
Ignoring the man's joviality, Gray stared toward the horizon, unable to shed his dark mood, knowing Amanda was not having this much fun. 1:30 a.m. The next contraction racked her body. Amanda sobbed, tears streaming down her heated face. Waves of nausea swept through her. Sweat soaked her gown to her skin. The worst of the pain was dulled by the mini epidural they'd given her, but not all of it. Dilated 8 centimeters, Petra reported from between her legs.
Right on schedule.
Dr. Blake stood at her bedside, evaluating a labor monitor.
That was a good contraction, but I'm pushing another bolus of Pit.
Pit was slang for Pitocin, a labor-inducing drug. He injected the medicine into her IV line, then turned his attention to Amanda. He took her hand, which was strapped in place to the bed, and gave her fingers a squeeze.
Would you like some more ice chips?
Fury cut through her. She dug her nails into the tender flesh of his wrist.
Fuck you, she spat at him.
She never swore, but it felt good to do so now.
You goddamn monster.
I'll get you some ice chips, he said, unfazed by her outburst. He gently but firmly freed his arm, then patted her hand.
Everything's going well. You're doing great.
Other medical staff worked at the periphery, monitoring vitals, trading out dirty linens that she'd soiled, dragging in equipment. A pair off to the side was preparing a radiant warming crib in anticipation of the newborn's arrival. Blake returned with a tiny paper cup full of crushed ice chips. He lifted it to her lips, but she turned her head away, refusing to cooperate in even this small measure. She willed her body to resist, too.
I won't let them have my boy.
But nature, fueled by strong drugs, couldn't be stopped. Minutes later, pressure again rose inside her abdomen, a storm front rising from deep inside her as relentless as the tide. She squeezed her eyes shut, knowing what was coming.
No. Please, no.
Her plea fell to ashes. The next contraction tore through her. She screamed,
not so much in pain as knowing she was losing this last battle.
Push, Blake said, but he sounded far away. She fought against it, but her body was no longer her own, transforming into a primitive machine, one forged in the evolutionary furnace of survival. Willing or not, all her flesh drove toward one function, to procreate, to move her genes forward into the future. She had no will but to obey. Abdominal muscles contracted in a crushing heave. Tissue ripped. Blood flowed. Pain became purpose.
The baby's crowning, Petra called out, her voice ringing in triumph.
Lost deep in the violence of birth, Amanda cried out to the world, surrendering to the inevitable, driven now by the basest of all maternal needs.
Someone save my baby.
1:44 a.m. Seated inside the ghost, Gray swiveled his chair to face the curved glass wall of the submersible. A pool of light cast by the sub's headlamps illuminated the dark waters around the vessel as it coasted away from Palm Jumeirah. The sandy seabed flowed a few feet below his toes. The effect was unnerving. The clear borosilicate shell allowed a full spherical view of the surrounding waters. Like floating in an air bubble, he thought, which wasn't far from the truth. The ghost was little more than a tapered glass cylinder strapped into a hydrogen cell battery propulsion drive. Ancillary electrical, mechanical, and engineering systems acted as an exoskeleton around the living quarters. Curious denizens, drawn by their light, would dart up, stare googly-eyed at the strange sight, then flash back into the blackness. He could imagine what they saw. The vessel reminded him of the neon tetras he once raised as a kid. He'd lie on his bed for hours, staring as the tiny fishes darted back and forth inside his aquarium. Tetras were best known for their iridescent blue and red racing stripes, but Gray had always been fascinated by their translucent skin. Their spine, ribs, even their quivering tiny hearts were exposed for the world to see. At the moment, he felt similarly naked, like he'd been swallowed up by a giant version of a glassy tetra. Still, he had to admit the panorama was stunning. One passenger wasn't as impressed.
This is so wrong, Kowalski said.
He was seated across from Gray. The big man had one palm against the glass window, another on the ceiling. He stared between his legs.
How long is this gonna take? What if we run out of air?
Gray recognized the space was cramped, especially for someone of Kowalski's bulk. Jack piloted the craft from a single seat up in the nose. The four chairs in back left little room to maneuver. Even Kane had to balance on Tucker's lap, panting at the view, ears high, trembling all over. Seishan sat behind Kowalski and reached a reassuring hand to touch his shoulder.
Calm down. We've got plenty of air.
She patted his back.
I'd be more worried about us springing a leak.
Kowalski swiveled in his seat, searching around the cabin with wide eyes. Gray gave her a scolding look. All they needed was a panicked bull in their midst.
How much farther? Kowalski moaned.
The answer came from up front.
We have to cross the entire world to reach your destination.
Jack tapped a button on a touchscreen interface. A heads-up display appeared above his controls, glowing against the window. It depicted a map of the surface, showing hundreds of tiny islands forming silhouettes of the seven continents. Gray recognized it as another of Dubai's projects. The world was one of the city's latest endeavors. 300 mini-islands off the coast, each offered for sale to private buyers. But financial concerns and problems with sand erosion threatened the development. The islands remained mostly deserted, with the sea reclaiming some. On the display, a red blip marked their progress as they navigated through this man-made archipelago. Beyond the window, a dark hummock of one of the tiny islands loomed. As they circled past it, A large ray, disturbed by their passage, shook out of the sand and sailed away from the light and back into the gloom. Other sea life appeared, growing more abundant as they glided through the shallows and wound past the small isles. Hermit crabs scuttled along the sandy floor. Pink anemone and green seagrass waved. A lone barracuda torpedoed past them, and schools of fish flashed and swirled in shimmering silvers and dazzling colors. Tucker suddenly swore. Kane barked. Gray turned to see a shoal of hammerhead sharks come lancing out of the darkness and shoot past overhead. They all inadvertently ducked. There was no real threat, but it was a sobering reminder of the dangers ahead. After a few more silent minutes, they left the world behind. The deeper seas beckoned. The ghost sailed out into the blackness, slowly sinking into the depths as the coastal shelf fell away. As they dove, the watery glow of the moon died overhead. The only lights now were their own. And even that had to end.
"Going dark," Jack warned. "You'll find your goggles under your chairs."
Before Gray could find his, all the exterior lamps clicked off. Blackness crushed around them. Kowalski gasped. The small lights from the control console were the only illumination inside the submersible, and even those went dim. Gray's fingers discovered the strap of his night vision headgear and tugged them free. He pulled the goggles over his head and settled them in place. The world beyond the sub reappeared again, lit now by the infrared LED emitters along the nose of the vessel. The goggles were able to perceive this spectrum of light, turning the world into a grayscale shadow of its former brightness.
"Don't want to ride up to Utopia with our lights blazing," Jack said. "Even with the sub submerged, someone might see us coming. Luckily, we don't need lights. I incorporated this naval IR system to accommodate for night dives. Makes for less of a rude intrusion into the dark world of our deep-sea denizens. Or when you need stealth. Like now."
The plan was to sneak under the island's security net. The surface radar defense system was meant to discourage pirate ships, like those in Somalia, from reaching the island's coast undetected. Additionally, armed security guards watched the docks and shorelines, and a small fleet of jet boats patrolled the waters around the island. Painter and Jack had already worked out an alternate entry point, but first they had to reach it. The ghost traveled another 20 minutes, soaring swiftly with the quiet burble of its engines. Jack worked his pedals and joystick to glide them along the seabed, riding over teeming reefs and across stretches of open sand. Positioned 10 miles from shore, Utopia had been built in waters 80 meters deep. It was an engineering marvel, the first deep-sea artificial island. The heads-up display continued to track their path away from the coast, mapping a bird's-eye view of their passage. At the top of the screen, the tip of one leg of the star-shaped island poked into view and slowly stretched downward as the ghost closed in on its destination. More of the island appeared, revealing its unique shape. But its shape was the least unique feature of the island. As they neared the tip of one corner of the star, a massive concrete pylon appeared out of the darkness, 20 yards wide. A forest of such towers lay farther ahead. This was the secret behind the engineering of Utopia. It wasn't so much an island as a massive fixed platform with a landmass sitting on top of it. Gray had read the history of Utopia. Its engineering was not new or groundbreaking, but based on technologies developed many years ago, patterned after the Hibernia oil platform constructed off the coast of Newfoundland in 1997. The same engineers and construction company had been hired as consultants for this Dubai development. In many ways, Utopia was an easier project. The Hibernia platform had been built in deeper waters and constructed in seas prone to rogue waves, Atlantic winter storms, and floating icebergs. The waters here were calmer, and the environmental threats less severe. On top of that, this location had been chosen for Utopia because of a natural coastal ridge. The outcropping had been reinforced and built up with boulders and compacted sand to form a protective crescent stretching 4 miles wide. Within those sheltering arms, Utopia was slowly constructed. Like Hibernia and other oil platforms, the island was basically a gravity-based structure, meaning the more weight on top, the more stable and secure it became. So while Hibernia was taller, Utopia was wider, the equivalent of 20 such platforms connected in a honeycomb cluster to form a star-shaped base. Atop this massive foundation, whose upper surface lay submerged to the depth of 5 meters, the same engineering techniques that built Palm Jumeirah were employed here, laying down a thick base of massive boulders on top of the platform, then flooding and covering it with dredged sand and compacting it all to the hardness of concrete. And within 5 years, a new island had risen out of the sea. "Now comes the tricky part," Jack said. He guided the ghost into that Brobdingnagian forest of massive steel-reinforced concrete pylons that supported the island. The columns rose from the seabed, set amid piles of boulders and mountains of ballast. He slowed their pace to a crawl. Gray craned his neck, staring up through the clear roof. In the distance, he could make out the bottom of the foundation platform. He imagined the crushing weight overhead, pictured the stack of corporate towers topside. Kowalski groaned. This time, Seishan didn't tease him. The sub suddenly rolled, heaving to one side. Jack swore, fought his controls, and righted them. "Sorry about that," he said. "Currents are tricky under here. In fact, one of the auxiliary power sources for the island is a series of tidal turbines, driven by the daily ebb and flow of the ocean. That same flow makes maneuvering through here a thorny bitch." They continued on for 5 more excruciatingly long minutes. The star-shaped island was 2 miles wide, but they only had to delve a quarter of that distance under its bulk. Still, that journey was nerve-wracking enough. "Sonar says we're here," Jack pointed up. Everyone searched in that direction. Far overhead, a tiny star shone in the darkness. Jack aimed for it, spiraling around one of the columns as he headed up. As they rose, the star grew larger and brighter, revealing itself at last to be a crack in the foundation platform. A handful of such breaks had been engineered into the project, serving as pressure-relieving points. In turn, the city planners had taken advantage of those construction necessities and turned them into various urban design features. "I'm turning off the IR emitters," Jack said. "You can take off your goggles. You should have plenty of ambient light to see." Gray pulled his night vision headgear off. The black and white world brightened into shades of aquamarine. The pool of light overhead bathed them in its glow. Jack set the sub to hovering in one spot. He dumped ballast to adjust their buoyancy, and the ghost floated smoothly upward, rising through the crack in the foundation platform, a 6-meter-thick wafer of concrete and steel. Once through, those industrial walls tilted back, sloping into sandy beaches. The sub slowed its ascent and glided forward until sand once again swirled a few feet under Gray's boots. Jack studied a small monitor at his control console. Spying over his shoulder, Gray caught a glimpse of the world topside as Jack employed a digital periscope.
"Looks clear," the pilot concluded.
The burble of the engines faded to nothing. Then a few seconds later, the sub's nose gently ground into the beach.
"That's as far as I go," Jack said, twisting around. "The top hatch is poking a couple of inches out of the water. You should be able to reach the shore without getting more than your boots wet."
That proved not to be the case. By the time Gray reached solid ground, he was soaked from the knees down. Seishan fared no better. Tucker disembarked last, assisted by Kowalski. The pair worked together to get Kane out of the sub. Gray had his team assemble beneath a grove of palms planted at the edge of the dark pond. It was hard to believe what lay hidden beneath that placid surface. An industrial hell of pylons, boulders, and ballast. It stood in stark contrast to the world above. Kowalski joined them. His gaze swept the landscape surrounding the pond, his face shining with awe. Gently rolling hills spread outward, covered in manicured lawns and dotted by other stands of palm trees. Beyond the parklands, towers and spires rose, forming a palisade of glass and steel. Some of the buildings were dark, girdled by cranes, under various phases of construction. Others thrust brilliantly into the sky, windows aglow, their exteriors flooded by lamps, amply demonstrating signs of life and occupation. Closer at hand, the rolling park was broken by patches of close-cropped greens, feathered with numbered flags. Elsewhere, silvery patches marked moonlit sand traps.
"We beached in a friggin' golf course," Kowalski said with a shake of his head. "You gotta hand it to the Arabs for working with what they got."
True enough. Gray returned to the pond, which served the island in multiple ways, as a landscape element, as a water hazard, and as a structural design feature. Jack remained aboard the Ghost, leaning half out of the hatch. He pointed a thumb toward the middle of the pond.
"I'll be hovering just under the surface, but I'll keep a watch for you with my scope. If you can't make it back here, you've got my signaling device. Set it off and I'll find you."
"Thanks." Gray patted his shirt pocket, indicating he had it. Jack hesitated before ducking away. His expression turned a touch embarrassed, like he wanted to ask something but held back.
"What is it?" Gray asked.
Jack sighed. "Maybe it's not my place, but how's Lisa doing?"
Gray had already spoken with Painter back in Dubai, so he knew the dire situation with Lisa and Kat. Worry for his friends remained a knot in his gut, but that wasn't what Jack was inquiring about. Gray read the real question in his eyes. "Is she happy with her life?" Gray answered that question as honestly as he could, but in regards to what Jack had asked directly, "How's Lisa doing?" he thought it best to lie.
"She's doing great."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.